Well, yeah, so anybody who teaches data structures ought to be thoroughly appalled by anybody who builds kernels. Okay. So, I promised an assignment, and you may have noticed it didn't come out, and I'm going to spend a bit of today explaining why. It's okay?
Yeah.
Well, you understand the project isn't going to get shorter just because it gets later. But there's an object lesson hiding in here somewhere, so we'll talk about that. So I actually want to spend about half of today talking about project issues, both in the sense of I do want to give a part of it out to get people going, and also to talk about why I wasn't actually able to get things started this week, because there's an issue that came up that's worth talking through. And then I want to go back in the other half of the discussion to I suppose we might call the object paging system inside Kyotos, which is not fully implemented, but there's a bunch of bits of what the relationship is between capabilities and objects and how that relationship is managed that I've sort of glossed over and promised to come back to, and might as well do that. So that's sort of the plan for today. Also, I managed to put the audio files up from last week and then forget to put up the links. I've been trying to hire desperately this week, which takes just an infinite amount of time. This has been entertaining. But hopefully I'll do better this week. The files often actually make it out there before the links do. So, and you may have noticed there's a naming pattern in the file names, so it's always worth a try. You've got very little to lose. The fact that nobody has complained suggests that nobody's actually listening to the files. This might not be the wisest decision people could be making. Okay. Let me start in on the interrupt problem. Let me start in on the project. So a really good idea for something to do this week, hint, hint, would be to get a copy of the Kyotos tree. There are instructions for how to do that in the developer's guide. And make sure you can build it. If you have attempted to do that, you will already have questions. And the fact that you don't suggests that you're hoping the project will go away. If you're hoping the project will go away, you are in for a disappointment. And it's always easier to sort of have already done the mechanics before you're trying to think out how to do the problem. So knowing how to build an image might be a good idea. So I would say get a copy of the tree. Make sure you can successfully build a kernel. You have accounts on CS418, which should have all of the necessary tools installed. You're welcome to try to do it on your personal machines. That's fine, too. There are maybe probably more limited instructions for how to go about it. The big issue, if your personal machine is not running, first, if you're not running Linux, forget it. I don't even want to talk to you about how to build this under Windows. It's just too much work. My answer will be, step one, install a virtual machine. Step two, install Fedora Linux, and then call me back. Okay, what's that?
That's what I'm doing.
I'm so sorry. actually, just yesterday, we're installing Windows under Xen on a machine for some testing. It's not a fun process. Mostly the updates that get you. What's that?
I said I had to install Windows yesterday. Hours.
Well, there seems to be a contest for who can take the longest time to update the operating system after you install it, right? So if you actually go look at the Fedora updates repository, you will realize that after you're done installing the original DVD, if you look at the amount of stuff you download in the updates, it now is very nearly the size of what you installed in the first place. Here's a trivia exercise if you have a bare machine you can afford to mess with. You know, do the Fedora install you want, okay? Log into the machine, use ripm-q-a, just get a count of how many packages there are. And then there's a command you can run, there's some set of options you can hand to Yum that says, tell me what you would have updated if only I had let you do it. And get a count of those, and you will find that there are now almost as many updates as there were original packages. Pretty amazing given that we know that they've been withholding some updates because Fedora 8 is coming. The weird thing is when your release cycle goes every 6 months, there's a tendency to say, that'll just have to wait until the next release, because the next release is sort of soon enough to say, well, you can just live with it, right? So the perverse effect is that when Fedora changed their release cycle from 1 year to 6 months, they actually lowered the timeliness of their product. It's a very weird social effect that happens here because of engineering limits, which is appropriate to the topic of the day. Get a copy of Kaedas, check out, get it built. If you're building on your own machine and if you're running Fedora, there are packages you can install that'll just get you the cross tools. If you are not running Fedora, or more precisely, if you're not running a RIPM-based Linux release, you will need to install the cross tools yourself. There are instructions for doing that. I would not pretend to claim that they are as well debugged as the package process. Cross tools are a sufficient pain in the posterior that we package them for a reason. It reduced the number of phone calls from people who are trying to use this stuff by a factor of 10. But confirm that you can build it, and not only that you can build it, confirm that you can run one of the test images. That's going to take some digging into the makefiles, but you should be able to fire up a copy of QEMU and run it on one of the test images and see it do basically nothing. But it will do nothing without panicking, and you'll see the kernel come up and run. Would it be helpful for me to arrange to sort of demonstrate that? I see that we have the overhead system, which has even been known to work on occasion. And I could bring in a laptop and I can just show you, walk you through it maybe next week. I could probably do it today, but I'm not 100% convinced that the laptop in my office is set up to do it. So let me bring in a laptop next week and do that. But get ahead because the project's coming. As to why the project isn't here, let me tell you about interrupts. Interrupts are the bane of kernel developers' existence. And let me also hand you a different assignment, not directly related to the project, but at least related to this issue. Go over to www.kernels.org. And at that site, you can download a tar file containing the most recent stable version of the Linux kernel. It's kernel singular.org? That's in spite of my chicken scratch, that's K-E-R-N-E-L. My parents tell me I'm the wrong kind of doctor, given the handwriting. Download the latest kernel, unpack it, and if you, in the resulting tree, if you look at, I think it's sys/IRQ, it might be kernel/IRQ. This is in the machine-independent portion of the code, and down in there you will find files called chip.c and handle.c. Chip.c, one of these wonderfully descriptive names, is the generic support routines for interrupt controller chips. Handle.c is actually some low-level support for dispatching the interrupt handlers. Actually, most of what you're going to want will appear in chip.c. It's also, this stuff has recently been reorganized in the Linux kernel, so if you don't have a relatively recent copy of the tree, you won't be looking at the right stuff. And it's a great object lesson in backwards compatibility, because the do IRQ routine that appears in handle.c is no longer supposed to be used. But when you have 5 billion people doing drivers, I promise you somebody hasn't updated. And there's a certain amount of legacy code living on here. I'm going to talk through some of this today, and what I want to talk through is what is the Linux model for handling interrupts, and why doesn't that model work for Kaedas, or more broadly, for a microkernel that does drivers outside of the kernel. And I also want to talk a little bit about probably not the most recent Linux driver model, because frankly I haven't kept up to date, but in abstract, what a traditional driver model looks like and how that's different from what happens in a microkernel. In a traditional driver framework, drivers divided into two parts, and these are traditionally referred to as the top half and the bottom half. Bottom half is actually not the bottom half. It's in a well-designed driver, it's like the bottom microscopic fraction. The difference between these two parts is that the bottom half typically runs with interrupts disabled. Well, no, that's not quite true. The bottom half is the part that is called in response to the interrupt having arrived. And in very early kernels, it often did run with interrupts disabled. Now, what's more common is the particular interrupt that has gone off will have been disabled. Other interrupts may still be live. And what will typically happen is that the operating system in question will have a very small, basically, set of priority levels for interrupts. What will happen is if a given interrupt goes off, that interrupt and interrupts in any lower priority levels, that is less important priority levels, will have been disabled. So let me give you an example of that. The network packets on a modern network can arrive very fast. Your character I/O arrives much slower. So perversely, you might even decide that the character terminal interrupt wants to be a higher priority interrupt because it's going to get out of the way and it's not going to happen very often. You could also decide, I want the network interrupt to be a higher priority interrupt because I better service it really fast. In fact, what you'll discover is the network interrupt is a high priority interrupt because the packets are coming very fast. So if you type on the character keyboard, you're going to get a certain class of low-level interrupts disabled. Those do not include the network interrupts. Network packet subsequently comes in. I'm skipping a step. What will happen when you type the character? Interrupt will come in. You'll enter the kernel because the interrupt forces you into the kernel if you're not already there. And the interrupt dispatch code will manipulate the interrupt chip to make things safe for humankind. And we'll get into that in a minute. And it will call the bottom half of the relevant driver. How does it know the relevant driver? It knows the relevant driver because at initialization time for the driver reached back, it poked around the machine, and said, I noticed the keyboard is sitting on the interrupt number 2. Which I know where the keyboard is sitting. Doesn't matter. It identifies the keyboard interrupt that the keyboard is on. I think it's actually 5 on the legacy PC. I would like to register to be the handler for interrupt 5. That's done at setup time. So when interrupt 5 comes in, what the kernel does is it says, okay, there are some set of interrupts I'm going to disable. I'm going to look up the handler procedure for 5. I'm telling a deliberately oversimplified story now. And I'm going to call that handler procedure. That means I'm going to call the bottom half. This is what I'm describing as the early design. This is no longer the current design. What's the bottom half going to do? Well, the bottom half is running with interrupts disabled. So there is strong, strong desire to make the bottom half as short as possible. Furthermore, the bottom half is running in a very peculiar state because we do not know what else might have been happening that we interrupted. The story I told was you were running in user mode. And we took an interrupt, and we drove into the kernel, and now we're doing the bottom half. But watch what happens next. Now I'm in this bottom half. I've disabled some of the interrupts, but not all of the interrupts. Now a network packet comes in. And the Ethernet chip says, me, I need some attention. And what's going to happen is we're going to interrupt the bottom half of the character interrupt, the keyboard interrupt, to go off and service the network interrupt. So if we were to look at the kernel stack, what we would discover is that there was a user stack in the application, okay? And when the first interrupt went off, we switched into the kernel stack and we ended up in the keyboard handler. Actually, we ended up in the interrupt dispatch code, which in turn called the keyboard handler. Then we took another interrupt while we were still in the kernel. This keyboard handler is the bottom half. Then we took another interrupt while we were in the kernel, and that drove us to the network driver, going into the Ethernet driver for the Ethernet chip. Now the bottom half of that. Now, this is a very peculiar state. I'll give you another possibility for where we might have been. We'll make it a little clearer why this is such a peculiar state. Suppose, instead of interrupting the application, what we had interrupted was a system call. The application did a voluntary transition into the kernel and made a system call. And in that scenario, the story looks a little different. Here's my kernel stack, okay? And on the kernel stack, I'm doing system call processing. And I take my first interrupt, and I'm now running the keyboard driver, bottom half of this. And that thing takes an interrupt, and now I'm running the network driver, bottom half. You can start to see the stack accumulating, right? It would be really bad to run off the end of the stack, and that's why there's a priority scheme, is to impose a bound. Excuse me, that's one of the reasons there's a
priority scheme
is at least partly to impose a bound on how deep the hole can get dug here. Good rule, if you're deep in a hole and trying to get out, stop digging.
Iterate the difference between.
The only difference between these two paths is that in the picture on the left, the first interrupt came in from the keyboard, I was already in the kernel doing something else. And in particular, I was in the kernel doing something else that was not an interrupt. That's the point I'm leading up to. Now, if you look at kernel code, what you will conclude is that the sort of mental picture for what's going on is that if I'm processing a system call, or I'm handling, actually, even if I'm handling an exception in some cases, the model is I'm running kernel code, and for the most part, and I'm sneaking up on what's the exception, I can access any variable I want. That's even true if I'm running something like a page fault handler, because the page fault handler can be thought of as a hardware-assisted system call. Page faults don't occur at random places. They occur because I'm executing an instruction, and the behavior of the instruction proceeds in an unusual way, but it doesn't just randomly happen in some arbitrary moment that I cannot predict. At least not an arbitrary moment with respect to the kernel execution. I mean, there are kernels where inside the kernel you maintain a page fault. As a general rule, if you allow that, you're very careful to make sure that those only occur at certain places where you're prepared to deal with them. A more common pattern is you design your kernel so the kernel does not take page faults. And the reason is this problem of what does it mean? The interrupt has preempted the kernel. If you allow a kernel to take page faults in arbitrary places, it can also preempt the kernel. Preemption is a problem if you are not prepared to deal with the consequences of being preempted. Explain why. So while I'm running the system call, I'm doing loads and stores. The compiler is free to reorganize those loads and stores under some, if you're a compiler person, annoyingly conservative, but if you're a kernel person, annoyingly liberal rules. If you do a bunch of arithmetic operations, the compiler, in most languages, is free to reorder those arithmetic. It's free to take divides and say, I'm going to do them with shift operations instead. It's free to say, well, yeah, I know you stored to this here variable, but then you went and used the result later, and then you stored something else to that variable, and so the first store is never going to be visible. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to keep the value in a register, and I will do the later store. The later store is going to overwrite the first store anyway, and you'll never know what happened. When can it not do that? Compiler cannot do that under basically two conditions. There are others, but broadly two conditions. One, if there's something called aliasing. If you do a store to a value, to a location, and then you do a reference through a pointer, another point, the possibility exists that that pointer points to the same location somewhere. In a strongly typed language, we have good filters for that. Because if the types, the pointers don't match, we're done. They can't point to the same location. And C, which is basically machine language with pretty syntax, pointers can lie. And so the compiler, generally speaking, cannot tell if references through two pointers might actually touch the same locations. And if it can't tell, the contract is it has to be conservative and has to actually do the store. One of the cases where this gets triggered is if you call a procedure. So if you call a procedure, now imagine we're talking about a global variable. If it's a local variable, rules are a little different. But if it's a global variable, question, do I have to do the store? Well, suppose the next thing you do is call a procedure. Do I have to do the store? Answer, well, do I know whether that procedure touches that global variable in some way? And the answer is, if I'm doing what's called global optimization, I might say at this point, well, I will go look. If I'm not doing global optimization, and mostly we don't, the answer is, I'm going to pretend that I'm not allowed to look. I mean, I'll cheat if it's in the same file, and I'll go look. But in general, I will assume that anything that might happen could happen, and I will behave conservatively, and I will do the store on the assumption that that procedure might do a reference. And it would get the wrong answer if I would fail to do the store. But the consequence of this is that in C code, there are many, many things that prevent the compiler from doing optimizations because of things that might happen. One of the reasons that local variables are better to use than global variables is The compiler is entitled to make much more aggressive assumptions about how local variables are used. In a loop, you have a variable int I, and you iterate across I from like 0 to 100. If I is global and you call a procedure inside the middle of the loop, I actually has to be written. It can't just be left in the stack, because the procedure you call might look at I. If that I, that same variable, is a local variable in the calling procedure, those are different. The legal usage model does not allow you to reach up the stack and look at that value of I unless you have explicitly taken the address of the variable I. If you take the address, we're back into the aliasing rules. If you don't take the address, the compiler is entitled to assume that you will not reach up the stack to look at a variable that is not in your current procedure. I mean, at assembly level, of course you could do this, but you are violating the language requirements if you do. The language does not require that you get the correct answer if you do that. The compiler is entitled to be more aggressive about optimization. Finally, going through this long-winded explanation of the compiler's behavior. Well, the language specification tells us some rules about which assumptions the compiler is entitled to make, and of course, by implication, which assumptions you should seek to avoid violating if you want your code to engage in sensible behavior. Interrupts violate all of those assumptions. Interrupt can come in between any two instructions, and it is, in effect, a procedure call. Notice, it's a procedure call having the property that the compiler can't see it coming. So the compiler has no opportunity to store things to their proper locations. The problem with doing code that runs at interrupt level is the code has to be extremely defensive. And the usual way you behave when you're trying to be this defensive is you say, okay, I have a kernel, right? It's got 400 global variables somewhere. Only three of them are variables that we are going to say we are permitted to use from interrupt level. Those three are going to have the property that we are always going to manipulate them with atomic operations, always going to use those atomic operations inside algorithms that continue to operate correctly if they are interrupted at arbitrary points. Needless to say, that's a hard set of constraints to meet in the real world. So second option is, of course, you run into the occasional algorithm where that's painfully awkward to do. So the next thing you do is say, well, and sometimes I'm going to have to live with an algorithm where I can't do that. Like, I don't know an algorithm for inserting something in a doubly linked list that will work that way without a compare and swap that will do two words at once, which most hardware doesn't have. Alternative, I disable interrupts. Do a linked list update and re-enable interrupts. Disabling interrupts will prevent me from getting interrupted on my own CPU, but I still have to deal with concurrency with other CPUs. That's a challenge. And he's locking too, and that's why the IRQ lock that I talked about last week or the week before combines in one operation disable interrupts and grab a lock, because they're two sources of conflict you have to deal with. So what's the big deal? I'll disable interrupts. The big deal is disabling interrupts is incredibly expensive. Disabling interrupts is no big deal. Disabling interrupts is incredibly expensive. Cause
enabling interrupts is incredibly
expensive. Here's what's going on. The interrupt is an asynchronous event. Because it's an asynchronous event, you know, it could happen at any time, right? So because it can happen at any time, the processor can lie a little bit about when it happened without being caught. I mean, it has to happen between two instructions. But exactly which two instructions is a little bit up in the air. If the processor recognizes the interrupt one instruction later or one instruction sooner, you're basically not going to know. At the moment that you disable interrupts, you've already issued some sequence of instructions in the machine. And you would not have issued those instructions if you had actually taken an interrupt. Here's the catch. So now this instruction that's disabling interrupts, I've got 20 instructions running around the machine. The last one is the one that enables interrupts. I'm speculating ahead, right? I don't actually know that I'm even going to get to this instruction. It could be that I have a load instruction somewhere in the middle of that 20 that's going to take a page fall. And if that load instruction takes a page fall, then the last 10 instructions, they never ran. The cost of speculating ahead is I have to be able to unspeculate. And disabling interrupts is something that alters the externally visible state of the processor. There are signals that exit the chip that change when you disable interrupts. Because of this, disabling interrupts can be, depending on the implementation, it's known as a serializing operation. It means you can't speculate past it. You actually have to make sure that all 20 of those instructions behind you are guaranteed to complete. They don't have to be done, you just have to know that they can't generate any more exceptions. See the problem? I'm looking 20 instructions ahead over the horizon. If something between here and there generates an exception, then it wasn't okay to look over the horizon, and I have to bring the horizon closer. The way modern machines develop their performance is by looking way far out for the horizon in the hope that everything works out. And, you know, some of the time it does. On modern machines, you may be a lot more than 20 instructions out, by the way. So disabling interrupts requires you to take all that parallelism in the machine and at least temporarily bring it to a halt. Because you have to guarantee that once you make this externally visible decision, that you're not going to have to undo it. The same is true about store instructions. You cannot allow a store instruction to proceed to memory until you know that the store instruction is actually going to run. Because if you update memory, and then the store instruction retroactively doesn't happen, you got a problem. There are whole research papers about how to manage memory consistency to deal with this kind of problem in your algorithms. Disabling interrupts is actually very expensive. Think of it, imagine that every time you disable interrupts, you're going to cut your processor speed by a factor of 20 to 40. Then you're going to disable the interrupt, and you're going to sit around and wait for 20 instructions, and then you're going to continue. Now, if you do this once in a while, not very often, that's not so bad. But if you have to do it all the time, if you have to do it on a hot data structure, that would be very bad. Enabling interrupts actually is less bad, because here's what happens in practice. You disable interrupts, you do like 8 instructions, and you enable interrupts. So the reason the 8 instructions part is good, you haven't actually started enough work for it to be hard to stop. You simply aren't 20 instructions ahead. Furthermore, enabling interrupts does not ever put you in a position where you have to back up. No, kind of, right? Actually, enabling interrupts is an I/O operation of sorts. It is externally visible off of the processor. So both of these things are serializing operations. So when you look at code that says locally disable interrupts, do something, locally enable interrupts, it's like 4 instructions in the middle, like a linked list update. That's very expensive code. Okay. So the end result of this is you try like crazy not to do anything that requires you to disable interrupts. If we're calling printf, who cares? Statistically speaking, printf is never called. It doesn't matter. But if we're calling something like the insert routine onto the system ready queue on a single CPU machine, who cares? An SMP machine, that's a hot data structure, right? If you got 2 processors, fine. You're not dispatching processes all that often. If you got 256 processors, it's another matter. 256 processors, you don't build one ready queue. You build a vector of ready queues to avoid hotspots. A hot data structure. I'll just spin it. The message I'm trying to get across is the kinds of programming that you can do in the bottom half are severely restricted by this problem of maintaining consistency across interrupts. But here's the design pattern that emerges given all of these ridiculously hard constraints. Basically, divide the universe into 3 kinds of things. Variables that are global to the kernel that thou shalt not touch in an interrupt handler. Do we break your fingers and tell you never to be caught writing kernel code again? Variables that are fully private to the driver. Not only private to the driver, but typically accessible only to the bottom half of the driver. These are variables that are only going to be accessed in interrupt mode, and they're only going to be accessed in the particular interrupts for this driver, so there's no conflict on those, except documentation. The class is variables that record state that has to be managed across the boundary. And I'm going to show you some examples of these. But one of them is this interrupt currently enabled? When the interrupt comes in, I'm going to temporarily disable it while I run the handler. Well, that's a bit that another path might need to check. To update that bit, you better do it with an atomic operation of some sort. That fit has to be consistent between the general code and the handler code. Needless to say, that's hard enough to do that the right answer is to avoid it whenever possible. So, because of the complexity of this, there was a design pattern that was used, I think, in the Linux kernel, and I'm probably going to get the description of it wrong because I haven't looked at it in a while. But here's how the design pattern went. It has something called a task mechanism. This is not a process. Task, think of it as a deferred procedure call. It's a promise that we're going to call a procedure later. What used to happen in some versions of Linux is the interrupt would go off, and the interrupt handler, you would basically say, I have to go run the bottom half. I will put on the task list a task that says run this bottom half. And I will immediately return from interrupt later. The idea is, the only data structure that I manipulate from action inside the interrupt structure is the list of pending tasks. Back to whatever we're doing. When the kernel reaches a point where things are stabilized and is ready to do these things, it says, there's a well-defined set of places where it says, okay, it would be convenient right now to run the tasks. Do I have any tasks that I have to run? If so, at that point, it would dispatch the tasks. So what's happened here is we've converted a preemptive activity into an activity that we're kind of doing visibly within the normal flow of control. That was the idea. There are a bunch of problems with this idea. The first is, it tends to lead to priority inversion problems, because the task system does not tend to respect the same priorities as the interrupt system, and you can get into situations where a system gets flooded with interrupts. It's also hard to make that design work in a way that respects CPU affinity. If the timer interrupt goes off on my processor, I don't really want your processor running the task, because the whole point is I'm trying to get something done on my processor. So I don't know where the Linux kernel is on that design now. There was a time when people were encouraged to use that mechanism, and then there seemed to be a time when it was going away. I don't know what the current state of it is. It looks to me now like it's actually mostly gone away. It's still supported for legacy reasons. But you see, the idea is tempting to say, well, take this thing that's very complicated to manage and just find a simple way to manage it. It's plausible that you would want to do that. It also interacts with how you deal with interrupts. Suppose I have an interrupt that comes in that is an edge-triggered interrupt. So what happens is, interrupt line makes a transition. That transition is the thing that actually is the interrupt going off, because it's measured by the transition from low to high, not by being low or being high. It's the change in state. What do you do about it? Well, the nice thing about this change in state is, once it's done, it's done. And the line can stay high forever, and I won't think another interrupt happens. So there are sort of two steps that might have to happen. One is to acknowledge the interrupt. When you acknowledge an interrupt, you're manipulating a state machine in the interrupt controller. The interrupt controller has a list of what interrupts it would like to tell the processor about. Think of it as a bitmask. These are the pending interrupts. Separately, it has a list of what interrupts it has delivered to the processor that are not yet completed. Depending on the interrupt controller, it may deliver multiple interrupts to the processor. So there are actually two interactions potentially between the CPU. The first says, I'm ready to receive the next interrupt. The second says, I'm done with the interrupt you gave. Most kernels actually don't differentiate those two because it's too complicated to nest things. What typically happens is, in an edge-triggered interrupt, you acknowledge the interrupt immediately. Until you acknowledge, you will not get any other interrupts, and you do not want to delay those other interrupts if they are higher priority. Further, you will not get this interrupt again, because the design of the hardware system says, until you go off and talk to the board that generated this interrupt, that line is going to stay high, and that board will not issue the same interrupt again. This interrupt can't come back. So the pattern, the simple pattern, is acknowledge, handle the interrupt, and depending on the controller, issue something called an EOI, end of interrupt. That's fine if there's only one piece of hardware on that interrupt line. Unfortunately, interrupt lines get shared. Shared interrupts are particularly disgusting things when they are also edge-triggered. One of the reasons that edge-triggered interrupts are going the way of the dinosaur is that it is very easy to lose them if you share the interrupt lines. What does that mean? I have a shared error. So when an edge goes off, I don't know which board produced it. A list of possible boards. It turns out in the legacy PC interrupt system, basically this could not happen because the hardware wiring simply did not permit lines to be shared in this way without shorting things. This is when your system fails the smoke test. But in PCI, you can have shared lines that are in edge triggered. A really bad idea, but it can be done. Why is it a bad idea? Well, think about what happens, right? I have a candidate list of boards, any of which could be the source of this interrupt. And what I have to do is go down the list of boards one at a time and say, are you his money? Or just, oh, I didn't even interrupt, I don't know anything about that. Nope, wasn't me. I'm not watching enough Saturday morning cartoons. Watch what happens. First interrupt that came in came from the board in the middle. So you start down the list, and the first board says, I don't know anything about it, go ask somebody else. And the second board says, yeah, it was me. So you are dealing with the interrupt on that board, still in the bottom half. The first board, who said, wasn't me, says, oh, wait, excuse me, I need your attention too. Touch the line high. Note that the line is already high because the second board has not yet had a chance to deassert the line. It's lost an interrupt. Because the line was already high, because the line was already high, there will never be a low to high transition that would tell you that another interrupt has occurred. So if you look at the Linux code, I pointed you at this directory, and the particular file you want to look at is chip.c. You will see that in chip.c, there is a procedure called handle simple IRQ. Then you'll find one called handle level IRQ and handle fast EOI IRQ and a bunch of different kinds of cases. And then down there you'll find handle edge IRQ. You'll notice that inside handle edge IRQ there is an infinite loop. The purpose of that loop is to avoid losing interrupts. Basically, you have to keep going down this list until everybody says, I don't have another interrupt. That's actually not quite true. I have to keep going down the list until everybody says I have another interrupt, and the interrupt controller agrees that there is no currently asserted interrupt. Then you know, really, everybody's done. The problem is, while you're going through, somebody else could assert a new interrupt. And if you're looking late, and an early guy asserts the interrupt, and the late guy drops the interrupt is still going to say hot. Because everybody pulls up, right? And the default is the line floats low if nobody pulls up. But if anybody pulls up, the line goes up. There are other systems in which it's the other way around. The active state is down, but that's not important. Part of this might be a tricky bit of business. You're engaged in a race with the hardware. So the design relies on the fact that the handler call happens in the middle. And what the current generation of Linux code does is it says, let's be optimistic. Let's assume that we're not going to get a second interrupt while this is going on. So we'll acknowledge the first interrupt, and we'll take advantage of the hardware protocols. If a second interrupt goes off, at that point we will mask further interrupts. There's a masking mechanism that says, I don't want to hear about interrupts here for a while until I tell you otherwise. Telling you otherwise is I unmask the interrupt, at which point you're allowed to deliver it to me again. There's a nesting trick going on here that, in my opinion, is over-engineered. So why am I going through all this? And let me go on to the level interrupt case, and then let me tell you what the problem is that stopped me from putting the assignment out. So in the level case, it's the fact that the line is high that tells you there is an interrupt pin. Not the edge that triggers the interrupt, it's the high level. Why it's called level trigger instead of edge trigger. As with any other interrupt, you can get multiple boards all sharing the same interrupt line. This is very common. One of the places where you'll see this almost universally is on cheap laptops. What they do is they take all of the PCI interrupts and they wire them to the same pin. Instant interrupt line. And the really annoying part about that is, when I say wired, I really mean wired. I don't mean they screw up the BIOS. I mean they screw up the motherboard. I fix that one from software. That practice seems to have largely gone the way of the pterodactyl, which is, and I don't miss it. But here again, you have to go visiting all the culprits to find out who generated the interrupt. And in fact, there could be multiple answers, because it could be two of them raised the interrupt. The good news is, you can go to the interrupt controller and say, has the line been deasserted? If the line has been deasserted, you know that nobody is still sitting out there with an unserviced interrupt. Of course, You look, they assert, you abandon, missed dinner. Ah, handle. If you look at the handle level interrupt, or with, I'm flipping pages here. Yeah, handle level IRQ. See, the pattern is a little bit different. The pattern goes like this. First step is mask the interrupt and acknowledge it in a single step. The acknowledge is saying to the interrupt controller, I have received that interrupt, I'm working on it. The and furthermore is saying, if you have other interrupts, it might be okay to tell me about them depending on the priority scheme that I programmed in the hardware. This part says, but don't bother me about this one again. Then it runs the handlers just like it did in the other case. And at the bottom, it unmasks the interrupt. Why is this important? As I'm going down this list, I'm looking at the third box, and the first box issues an interrupt. What's going to happen is this. I'm going to go down and run the handlers one at a time for those boards that have an active interrupt. And I'm going to declare a victory. It could be that the first board, in the meantime, has attempted to deliver an interrupt. So it's raised the line high. It did this before the last board lowered the line. So at the end, the line is still going to be high. This is all over. I'm going to unmask, and I'm going to do an end of interrupt. There are some details about, on some hardware, the end of interrupt can be done automatically by the hardware. Here's what happens. The unmask part says, okay, I'm going to take another interrupt on this line. The interrupt says, I'm done taking the last interrupt on this line. And in hardware that processes level triggered interrupts, if you issue an end of interrupt and the line is still high, the hardware immediately turns around with a hammer and then whacks you over the head again and says, hey, you've got an interrupt. That's actually nice here because it means that if you walk off the end of the list and the first guy issues an interrupt behind you, you'll get forced to go back and look, which is exactly what you want. That's why level triggered interrupts are strongly preferred to edge triggered, because the reality is, no matter how cleanly you design the hardware, sooner or later, somebody will run out of interrupt lines, and the next thing that will happen is that they will decide to share one, hopefully for two interrupts that don't happen very often. If you shared the high-speed networking interrupt with something else, you are not going to be a happy camper. Todd's nodding his head like he's tested this empirically. By the way, you'll be amazed how many BIOS vendors don't understand that. The BIOS basically does an initial assignment of interrupt lines. That assignment is always terrible. And there seems to be this correlation, I mean, at the risk of you've noticed that I'm really shy about beating people up in public. At the risk of insulting people, I've noticed the correlation that the biggest vendors of PCs, right, the ones who sell the largest number of PCs, are also the ones who are the worst at building decent BIOSes because they just don't care. I mean, sometimes wonder why, but I don't think I've ever been to find out. So you can see that there's a subtly different process. And the subtly different process lies in the mask and unmask, which in the edge trigger case, there's no point doing because the mere fact that you have an edge already tells you everything you could want to know. The edge trigger case, the reason you would mask is to implement interrupt priorities. So if you said, oh, well, when I get interrupt 5, I should stop considering 5, 7, and 11. All those in my scheme, in my software-defined scheme, all those are associated with devices that are in an equal priority band. So the reason I'm going to mask them is because while I am handling 5, I also don't want to get 11. But that's not something I'm doing. It's required by the algorithm that I'm using to manage interrupt 5. That's something that I'm doing to impose a priority discipline on the system design. I may do the same trick for level trigger. In the level trigger case, the masking gets exploited to help me build the algorithm in a more straightforward way. We pause and ask right questions or comments about this. That's probably alien to some of you who are totally confused. Okay, but I mean about this. Seriously? Can you articulate a question or is it past that?
No, I'm taking question.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
I guess the sharing problem is a lot worse when they interrupt.
So if you share two interrupts that you want to think of as being, so basically once the interrupts are on the same wire, yeah, the shared physical structure has the effect of of requiring them to be at the same priority level. But yeah, sharing at different priorities is just a really bad idea. But these days, there's enough interrupt lines that if you're doing that, you've got other problems. Yes?
Yeah.
I did not say you did not have other problems. I said if you're doing this, you have other problems. You are doing this, therefore you have other problems on your laptop. Sony is actually one of those helpful vendors who routinely gets their BIOS wrong. Oh, don't shake your head. You know, you're a ThinkPad owner. Your situation is much better. Whoops.
Yeah.
Well, no, but that's actually not so bad because graphics cards don't actually issue interrupts, so who cares? Oh, wait, you were doing video? Okay, so the only time graphics cards issue interrupts is when you're doing gaming because you want to update during the vertical retrace interval. Most of the time, people don't do that, so people figure, oh, well, the graphics card is a good thing to share because it's not going to issue any interrupts. All of the interrupts I don't handle don't cost me anything. Actually, not a bad heuristic as long as the assumption is true. People sort of get the general idea that there's a protocol here that involves an order of operation where I'm going to do certain steps in a certain order, and the reason the order of operation is important is because of the sharing issue, because I could lose track of what I'm doing.
You have?
Yes, in fact.
I mean, that's what they look like.
Yeah. Well, so it turns out that to first order on a PC, there are only two choices. You either have an IOA pick or you don't. There are other reasons to want to probe the IOA pick to find out which broken IOA pick you have, because you need to fix different breakage on different IOA picks. There are a couple of very special vendors that I will not name. But by and large, you're either doing the old style or the new style. There's some artifacts of wiring that people occasionally wire things in funny ways that the software has to work around, and that's the rotation. And it does complicate this picture, but I'm not trying to do a perfect interrupt system. I'm trying to get an idea across. Notice some things that do not happen this path. Do not schedule any processes during the handling. You may schedule some upper halves to run. Typically what happens is the bottom half says, oh, good. Bottom half of the network driver says, oh, good, I have another packet. Let me put the packet into a buffer that has previously been allocated, so I have exclusive access to it now. Let me mark the top half to run of the driver, and the top half will actually do something about the packet. My job is to notice that there is a packet. The top half's job is to do something about it. What we do not want to do is have the interrupt driver be pushing that packet up the network stack, because the network stack is a big piece of code. The job of the bottom half is to be done, preferably before it begins. So typically what we'll end up doing is marking the top half as needing to be run. Very little, and the top half happens in that scheduled way, that there are well-defined points where the kernel says, okay, should I be running a top half? Those don't run afoul of the compiler assumptions. How about those microkernels? Look at what happens in the microkernel. The interrupt comes in a microkernel, we don't have a handler for it, because the microkernel doesn't handle interrupts. There are some, right? It probably handles local timer interrupts. Although, you can have holy wars among microkernels. So if you ever want to start a holy war, this seems to be a popular thing to do in the last few years. If you want to start a holy war, go to a serious operating systems conference, right? Wait for the break, you know, when everybody goes out to the donuts or the muffins or the fruit or whatever they're serving, right? And say loudly to somebody that interrupts absolutely should not be handled in the kernel and scheduling should be done by application, okay? And, you know, somebody will respond to you, right, turn to somebody else and provoke them a little bit, get the two of them arguing with each other, and then just step back. Okay? This is good for hours of entertainment. Well, if you have a certain kind of notion of entertainment, anyway. It's especially good if the people you're doing it to don't realize you're doing it on purpose. Certain members of the L4 community are reliable, repeatable victims for this. Don't tell them whoops. I'm kidding. Besides which, all of them now know me, so they don't fall for this anymore. It's much less fun now. I just know I'm going to take shit about that. You guys don't listen to the recordings, but they actually, some of them do. So let's ignore the holy war about the timer interrupt because there are good arguments on both sides of it. Let's talk about the character driver, the keyboard driver interrupt. What do I want to do when that interrupt comes in? Well, look, the hardware is going to issue the interrupt. And that is going to force me into the kernel. So there is something the kernel's going to do. And our goal is to make it as little as possible if we have drunk the microkernel Kool-Aid. How many of you are too young to understand what the hell people are talking about when the expression drunk the Kool-Aid is thrown?
Too young. Okay.
Does the name Jim Jones ring a bell? This was a guy who basically was a religious leader who took his congregation off to someplace and served them all poison Kool-Aid and killed them all. So the whole drinking the Kool-Aid, this is not a good thing. I don't recommend that you test this. What's going to happen is the interrupt is going to go off, and what we're after is to say, well, it's not the microkernel's job to do work, it's the microkernel's job to get somebody else to do work, and the way microkernels get somebody else to do work is they cause some process to be a candidate for scheduling. So in a perfect world, what would happen would be we would acknowledge the interrupt, and we would discover that there was a process conveniently waiting for this interrupt. This process has previously called a kernel interface that says wait for interrupt. It's asleep. It's blocked on a stall queue in the kernel. And we're going to say congratulations. You are now the proud, lucky owner of a brand spanking new shiny interrupt. Go to town. We're going to put it on the ready queue, and we're going to run it when the scheduler is damn good and ready to run it. By the way, by making it the scheduler's problem, notice that we mostly avoid the priority inversion problem of interrupts, right? Remember I talked about the two-level scheduling problem. So all interrupts in this scheme are treated equally badly. We basically pay just enough attention to the schedule of process, and that's it. What's the process going to do? Suppose we're talking about the network interface. I'm going to make up a number. The network interface is running on interrupt 7. We have just scheduled but not dispatched the networking driver. And to be clear, conceptually, what we have scheduled to run is the bottom half. It's just that's no longer a kernel activity. Once it is scheduled, there is no point scheduling it again until it has run. So there is no reason to unmask the interrupt at this point. In fact, there's a lot of reason not to unmask the interrupt. The effect of unmasking the interrupt will provide no benefit because we've already done everything we can possibly do by scheduling this driver to run. If we take more interrupts on that line, the driver will still be just as scheduled as it was before. The only thing we will accomplish is that we will go in and out of the kernel a lot, discovering that we need to schedule this driver, which has already been scheduled. But we want to leave the interrupt masked, and there's no point taking it again until there is somebody listening. When would somebody be listening? Somebody's listening when the driver comes back and says, wake me up when that interrupt happens. Until somebody is asleep waiting for the interrupt, there's no point unmasking the interrupt. So the algorithm structure doesn't work so well because the assumption is that the handler is running in the middle and we're immediately going to unmask the interrupt. What happens in a microkernel-based system is rather different. Driver, which is an application, calls wait for interrupt, and presumably it tells us directly or indirectly which one. Now conceptually, and this story is not quite going to hold up, let's go through it, we'll see where the problem is. What should now happen inside the kernel is we should have a stall queue associated with interrupt 7. We should enqueue this process onto the stall queue. Now somebody's waiting. And after we enqueue the process, we should unmask this interrupt. Because until somebody was waiting, there was no point to unmasking it because there was nothing we could do about it anyway. What happens when we unmask that interrupt? Assume for the moment the answer is nothing, but I got to come back to this. Because there is a possibility, this is what I'm going to come back to, there's a possibility that we will immediately get whacked with the interrupt because the interrupt has in fact been pending. And the minute we unmask it, we're going to get hit with a hammer. But let's assume for a minute that doesn't happen and we proceed. And later, some unspecified later time, but after we're out of this in an orderly way. Oh, sorry, skipping something important. Here, we're going to call a sched abandon transaction. Why abandon? We cannot make forward progress on this call. Have to sleep. Given that we are sleeping, There's no reason to restart the transaction. In fact, we don't want to restart the transaction. We want to stay asleep. But notice that we have to be a little careful that we have to go to sleep, unmask, and then get out of the kernel, and we have to do it in that order. Normal procedure, it's very rare in the kernel that you have a step after going on the stall queue. The more common pattern is go on the stall queue and get out of the way as a single operation. In this case, we have another thing that has to happen in the middle, because if we unmask first, that would be not good. We can miss an interrupt that way. I'll cut you off. Separately, what's going to happen is that the interrupt is going to come in, and we're going to have a kernel interrupt handler. What the kernel interrupt handler is going to do is it's going to mask interrupt 7. Not interested in this interrupt now until the driver's running again. And it is going to do a wake up on stall Q7, waking up the driver. Driver will now go run and hopefully do something about it. I'm assuming level triggered, and this should be masking it. Okay, there are a couple of problems hiding in there, which is why I've done this whole long exercise. Notice that the handler is no longer running in the middle. In fact, this wake up path, immediately after the wake up, we're going to return. Why are we going to return? Because the process that we interrupted is not done with its slice yet. What's actually going to happen is that the wake up call is going to say, well, the guy I woke up, is he higher priority than the guy that I'm running? If so, I'll make a note that I need to preempt the current process. That's going to happen after this return. There's a check on the way out of the kernel to say, are we returning to someone who's supposed to be preempted? If we are, then we're going to abandon the transaction and start somebody else, and that will turn out to be the new high priority process. Notice there's no actual work related to the interrupt handling here, except to mark it as something to be ignored until future notice. First of all, what happens if the interrupt shared? There are two possible designs. One says, I can have multiple drivers, they will all go to sleep on this stall queue, and I'll just wake them all up, and one of them will win. That design doesn't work very well. Let's take the video card and network card example. Those are both on interrupt 7. What's going to happen is that sometimes they're both going to be sleeping, and a network packet is going to come in, and we're going to wake them both up. Turns out running the network driver takes some time, so a fair bit of the time what will happen is that the video driver will get in there and decide there's nothing to do and immediately go back to sleep. And when it goes back to sleep, we will call unmask. And we will abandon, and having called unmask, guess what happens? I promise you there's another network packet in the queue. The network driver is still trying to run. What's going to happen is we're going to end up waking up the video driver a lot pointlessly, and it is going to tend to spin in the cycle of trying to sleep and getting woken up, and trying to sleep and getting woken up, because actually there's nothing for it to do. This is the heart of the problem with shared errors. Second possible design. We will impose the rule that you only allow one driver to sleep in the kernel for an interrupt. That's the current intended design. Yeah.
So before you move on, why couldn't you have a system that says if you wake up three drivers, they all have to ask before you actually unmask?
What will happen then is that you will miss interrupts the other way. The video interrupt will come in, video driver will run. While it's running, you will not be able to process network interrupts. What you'd like is you'd like to be able to figure out which card was the source very quickly and dispatch the appropriate handler. In effect, you would like to be able to demultiplex the sharing to figure out who's the right party to blame. The problem here is that the kernel doesn't have enough knowledge to do that. The second possible policy is saying, well, what we're going to do is we're going to have one process that camps on this interrupt line, and if the line is shared, that party's job is to figure out how to demultiplex the interrupt. That might be done by running around and poking the cards and saying, did you generate this interrupt? Or it might be done by kicking off all of the appropriate drivers and then waiting until they're all done. You've actually hit on the heart of why shared interrupts are a problem, right? They tend to have the effect of serializing the handlers. If you know enough to give a straightforward algorithm that can tell you, did this card produce this interrupt, you can even imagine designing a custom probe language You would download proroutines in the kernel so it could do that job. Or you could run those proroutines at application level in the first level interrupt handler. There are other kernels, I believe HPUX at least used to work this way, in which there's a layer smaller than the bottom half, which is called the fast handler, I think. And the fast handler only does enough work to figure out which card should actually have its bottom half run so that it can schedule the correct bottom half. Why is this a problem? Because the effect that we just talked about, where if you run the wrong driver, it happens in Linux design as well. The difference is it happens without an intervening context switch or multiple context switches. So the expense of running the wrong handler, as long as it can quickly get out of its own way, the latency that it adds is not so bad. So this is the catch with microkernel design, is that when you see, as long as the interrupts are not shared, you're dispatching the right unit. Interrupts are shared, the cost of figuring out who is the right guy to dispatch becomes much more expensive. This becomes a design issue that you have to manage. Why is this a problem? Certainly not impossible to do. We have existing examples of operating systems that do this successfully. The reason it's a problem is, you know, realistically, if you're writing a new operating system, there are 4 billion cards in the world, right? And you can't write all of those drivers. So you then conclude, Linux is a very nice driver library. And in order for, or FreeBSD or OpenBSD or one of the open source operating systems, probably not Windows, they're very upset. They have no sense of humor about this at all. The problem with that is the design assumptions of those drivers assume that they're running inside the handler in a low latency environment. It'll all be fine if you don't share the interrupts, but if you share the interrupts, you're going to notice the hit. There's a set of engineering problems, really there's a set of real-world compatibility problems that are just a huge impediment for building any new operating system. This is why you don't see a lot of new operating systems that get past the I have a cool idea stage. They spend hundreds of millions of dollars doing drivers. Okay, so, catch. One of the things that you want to be able to do is probe to find out, I have a card. Which interrupt does it think it's generating? And the way you do this is enable every interrupt you can find, and you provoke the card into generating an interrupt. And then you find out what interrupt it generated. If you're a bit careful about this, you can use this to basically thump the card and figure out what interrupt it's actually going to generate. There are some cards, fortunately older cards, where this is just about the only way to find out what interrupt the card is going to generate. I guess some of the early buses, thank God these are mostly going away, but people will reinvent them in other contexts. Some of the older buses were not good about telling you where things went. Also, can get interrupts that don't really exist. There are noise sources, electrical noise sources in PCs. Have any of you actually looked at the motherboard of a recent PC? Have you actually opened up a PC and looked at the motherboard? Oh, people not. Who has not? Who's never looked at the motherboard? How many people are awake? That's promising. That's promising. We actually got a response to that. Because those are the same people who raised their hand last week and said they were not going to answer no matter what question I asked. So, okay, if you have not opened up a PC to look at a motherboard, do it. You're not going to hurt anything. Turn it off. I'll stick your fingers in there. The truth is you won't probably do much damage that way, but why take a chance? One of the things you'll notice if you look at the actual board is you'll notice that the lines on the board are all nicely curved. There are no sharp edges on those lines nowadays. Used to be, you'd see all kinds of corners. You'd see boards that had 90 degree turns in a line. Then you'd see boards that only had 30 degree turns in a line. Then it was 15 degrees. And then it was everything's curved. You know why that is? What's that?
Aesthetics.
Aesthetics. These are the same people who designed BIOS advertising. Okay, that goes up there with neither, right? words, not likely. What do you think it is?
Isn't there something to do with magnetic generated by the current field, something?
On the right track.
I'm
By any chance, do you know where the ECE department is? How many of you know where the ECE department is? Okay. Basically, the answer is at sufficiently high speeds, electrical signals do not like taking turns any better than your car does. You may have noticed a high correlation between sharp turns on roads and cars in the tree just past the sharp turn on the road. Personal favorite, I was driving over Highway 17 on my way to Davenport in California one day, and this is a road that's just twisty-turny, and I mean, it's terribly dangerous, and there are basically two classes of people on the road, people who know it and people who have no business being there. This is true to the degree that the algorithm, if you're a state trooper and you're doing speed enforcement on that road, is if the driver sees the state trooper and does not hit the brakes, you leave them alone because they know the rules. Very unofficial. If you see the state trooper and you hit the brakes, you will be pulled over. The reason is there's a trade-off because it's a very heavily traveled road. Actually pulling over a car is extremely high risk of creating a multi-vehicle accident because there's no place to pull over. It's a road that was designed for about 40 miles an hour and it is routinely driven at 70. It is a twisting, winding road and it is driven at following distances more appropriate to 30. So the goal of the state trooper is to guarantee that the people who don't know the road well enough to stay with the pack get out of the way. They are not doing speed enforcement. They are doing idiot enforcement. So one day I'm coming over the hill and I'm driving down the road and I look up and there's a Volkswagen Bug parked in a tree 15 feet above the roadway. And I swear to you, it looked like the thing had just been parked there. I mean, it must have gone up the back end of some car in front of it in some terrible accident and just got left there because what are you going to do about it? Right? You know? Yeah. Pretty soon the tree will drop its leaves and its bugs and you'll get... okay. So high-speed electrical signals do not like taking turns any better than that Volkswagen did. I really hope the battery was okay. Looked undamaged. That was the really amazing part. I mean, I don't know, given the number of like Ferraris and Porsches on that road, there are a lot of inclined planes. So you can imagine, you know, just taking off. And... Okay, the rest of you can review the tape when you get home. What happens if you do a sharp turn on a motherboard is you get something called a microwave transmitter. Microwave transmitters and pacemakers are not compatible. You've noticed the little warning on your microwave, which says, don't climb in here if you have a pacemaker. Now, any of you who've tried this will rapidly figure out that it's just not really likely that you're going to climb in there. To the hell of a microwave. I have actually seen microwaves that big, but not in a kitchen at home. So the problem is that these things are radio sources, right? And they're radio sources for very high frequency ranges of energy, some of which are actually dangerous. And to the degree that if you had sharp angles on the board and you operated the machine without an appropriate case, and the machine was operating near your face, you could destroy your vision. The microwave source will cook your eyes. I mean, your eyes are great, right? They have high fluid content, right? They're very responsive to heat. They're very easy tissue to destroy, and microwaves happen to be really good at destroying that kind of tissue. That's why your microwave won't operate with the door open. People have reported a correlation between a heavy cell phone use and damage to eyes. The science on this correlation is, you know, back and forth whether there's anything to it. But it's one of the reasons that for a while the power rating you were allowed to have on a handheld phone was significantly lower than the power rating that you were allowed to have on something called a bag phone. And the difference was the bag phone was something you lugged about and something that looked like a purse. Okay, and it was a much larger distance away from your face and therefore from things that might be fried by the microwaves. You did know that your cellular phone works in a microwave range, right? And that's why these boards don't have straight lines. I don't remember why I got off onto that at all. Except for
interrupts that don't exist.
Right. So the absence of straight lines does not mean that the CAD system owned by the board designer was correctly operated at all times. Nor does it mean that the chip designers are perfect. Well, of course, the Intel chip designers are perfect, but I'm really glad you laughed at that. Have to learn somewhere. So there's crosstalk, and there are various sources of crosstalk, and some of them have to do with signal interference. You want to hear it? Run the network at high speed on any machine that has an AC97 audio chipset.
It works for
even a lot of the normals. Yeah. The Ethernet chip is a not very well shielded high frequency noise source, right? The AC97 audio chip, it's not designed for this, but it's actually a reasonably efficient radio receiver. And it's a radio receiver that's there for the primary, if you think about it, right? The signals going across the wires on your motherboard or radio, they're high frequency signals, right? The purpose of this chipset is to convert those signals into noise, which you interpret as music, but that's your problem. Well, the chip doesn't really care what the source of the radio signals is. It's perfectly happy to take signals from the Ethernet chip and convert them into noise, which you interpret as music, but that's your problem. If you hear Kiss on your sound system, right, the next thing you try is to turn off the Ethernet. Or the other common source is the FireWire is implemented next to the chip. FireWire is a very noisy source. This is not well shielded. So, good, so how did I get onto that? I was talking about response latency on interrupts, I think. No idea. Right, so these things show up as interrupts that did not actually have any source. Or rather, the source was some unrelated chip that generated electrical noise that provided just enough activity on your line to look like an interrupt for a while. A well-designed motherboard shouldn't do this. Then there's reality. Reality is, hey, if there's a crazy thing your board can do once in a blue moon, just sell them enough so you have no hope in hell of fixing it, it'll do it. Okay. So, you're going to run handlers where the answer is nobody says it was my interrupt. And this is particularly fun when you're probing boards to find out what interrupts they generate, because Murphy loves us, and that will be the moment that you will take a serious interrupt. So if you actually go look at the code that used to do this probe, step one, tell everybody to shut up. All your cards, just tell them to go away. Step two, enable all of the interrupts. Step three, thump the board you're trying to analyze. Get an interrupt. Right? Step four, consider the hypothesis that this interrupt might actually have been correct. Thump the board again and see if you get it again. Okay? And after a certain number of repetitions, you conclude that this was not a spurious interrupt. And there are ways in software to detect spurious interrupts. All of these things rely on some latency characteristics that this design basically doesn't, microkernel design basically doesn't give you. There is a latency mess, and it's exacerbated by shared interrupts, and it's further exacerbated by running drivers in user mode because of context switching latencies. The good news is those drivers are going to run within the scheduling regime of the system, and the bad news is that means there are opportunities to design the scheduling regime of the system badly so that you won't get good latency behavior. This is a two-edged sword. Notice that while the driver may not get kicked off so quickly in this design, it is also the case that you won't get any more interrupts until it does. So you will not tend to get interrupt storms in this design, because this is one of those cases where being slower actually works in your favor under pressure. Why? Take that network card. It has something called a FIFO. It's a buffer. What you would like to do is maximize the number of packets per interrupt without losing any. And that's not even quite precise. If you're under attack, you actually do want to lose them. 99% of your packets are garbage. Losing them is the right strategy. But perversely, what happens is that the way to activate the driver causes you to have more stuff in the FIFO by the time you go to look. You can actually measure the effect that says at a certain point, slowing down the interrupt rate actually helps you because it takes time to notice the interrupt. And the time that you're taking to notice the interrupt is time that you're not spending to deal with the message. So there are very curious systemic effects here. You might imagine, hey, putting my driver behind a slow context, which is really going to hurt. If it's slow character traffic, you don't care. The latency isn't an issue. You just don't type that fast. If it's really, really fast networking traffic, you don't care. The slowdown in interrupts is lowering your wasted overheads, and it actually works in your favor. The threshold below that, where indeed you're taking a penalty. There's been some good work on this in the networking community, a couple of good SIGCOM papers, on how to notice when it's time to switch your interrupt management strategy to balance the performance against the overhead of the interrupts. Any of those strategies just fall out more or less for free by just slowing down a little bit. The perverse outcome is sometimes slowing the interrupt service rate down improves your performance. And that is a really perverse outcome. The reason I didn't get the assignment out last week as promised is I dug into this thinking, oh, well, yeah, I need to take the established code that runs in 14 other operating systems that I can look at and modify it, and we'll be good to go. The answer is no. Whole interaction in the interrupt controller is actually quite different. And now something else is different. Move on is being driven from a system call, right? This is happening in the part of the kernel that can touch general global variables. Wake up is happening from interrupt level. This is happening in the part of the kernel that should not, in general, touch variables. Which variable does wake up touch that we really care about? What do you have to do to wake up a process in the kernel? What does it mean to wake up a process? Right after this point. But what does it mean to wake up a process? What am I actually doing when I wake up a process? Is that it? I have to update curse CPU. Moving it from a stall queue to the ready queue. Actually, it's the process structure, but you're exactly right. I'm moving it from the stall queue to the ready queue. I'm moving it from a particular stall queue, which is the interrupt stall queue, and interrupts are funny things. So actually, in this case, it's not the stall queue that's the problem. Why would I care about the ready queue here? Who do I care about? I mean, does the fact that I'm touching the ready queue matter? What kind of data structure is the ready queue? What?
Is it a
link? Not a singly linked list, it's a doubly linked list. And because it's a doubly linked list, we don't know of a wait-free data structure that works. Is it a data structure that I look at very often? Hot data structure in the ready queue? Some designs, it's a really hot data structure. So I'm going to manipulate it from interrupt level, and I cannot do it with a wait-free or atomic data algorithm. What do I have to do instead?
Blocks.
I can't.
Who block?
Block. Block?
Locks.
Locks. Yeah. Bagels. And locks.
Oh.
Yeah.
So how does an interrupt handler take a lock? What?
If it's gold.
Suppose I'm an interrupt handler, and I go to take a lock, and it is currently held by somebody else. How soon am I going to get the lock? Eventually? What about if it's held by my own CPU? I will never get the lock because I have just preempted the code that might release the lock. That code, yeah. Trains are scheduled to come to a crossing, right? Both must stop and both must wait until the other is passed out of sight. Okay? Deadlock. So I have to guarantee if interrupt level is ever going to take a lock, I have to guarantee that at any time when the interrupt might take the lock, it will not be competing with the same CPU for the lock. Cross-CPU competition is okay. That will eventually get out of the way. Self-CPU competition is not okay because it will never get out of the way. So what do I have to do? Disable interrupts. Where? Interrupts are already disabled with the interrupt handler.
Even though
I have to disable interrupts in the general code whenever I am manipulating that lock. All know disabling interrupts is cheap. So it would be a really good idea to disable interrupts on a hot data structure. Anybody see a problem here? Wake up from inside the interrupt handler is a problem. Thank you is about as hot as data structures get. It's hot enough to care. Let me give you a rough metric. The kernel will tend to make at least one scheduling decision every time it goes through the kernel, if only to check, is there something more important to do? We're now proposing that in order to do that check, it has to disable interrupts and acquire a lock. In the original Linux multiprocessor design, there was a quick and dirty thing was introduced called the grand kernel lock. Whenever you entered the kernel, you grabbed this lock. If somebody else had it, you waited. And what this guaranteed was that you effectively had only one active thread of control in the kernel at a time. That was good up to a CPU and a half, which was better than most people would get. It was not crazy. And the proposition was, yes, we know this is a stupid thing to do, but it will let us use the two core processors that are out there, we'll get some value out of them, and we'll figure out what's the right thing to do and take our time. They then did 3 times, but they did eventually convert. Now, why was it that on a two CPU system, and you really ought to see like 1.95x on a two CPU system, Why is it you only got 1.5? Actually, I think it was 1.4. Because people go into the kernel all the time. It was a high contention log. And I said, we're going to check the ready queue once on every path through the kernel. It's a curious thing. If the kernel paths are very long, we check the ready queue once. And you have this big long path and some very tiny fraction of it where we're doing this check. We're going to see some contention. Typically, you won't be looking at the same time I'm looking. Even if we're both in the kernel, we're probably not looking at exactly the same time. The contention on the grand kernel lock is not actually a good predictor of the contention on the ready queue lock. The reason that's true is the kernel path lengths are long. The kernel, the goal is to make the kernel path lengths as short as we can make them. And the shorter they get, the more likely it is that you and I are looking at the ready queue at the same time. The concern is, the grand kernel lock may actually be a very good predictor of the performance of the ready queue if we have to grab a lock to look at it. Certainly if we have to disable interrupts, because that is a serializing thing and it takes a long time. But you see, there's a problem, right? We really want to avoid this situation. Let's break. When we come back, what I'd like you to do is, as you're wandering the halls, just run the back of your head, see if you can come up with a trick that would let us get out of this problem. There is a way out. Come back and look at it.